Our political leaders and journalists seem to be occupying themselves with the Middle East. And it's very easy, with the focus on the Middle East, to overlook our extensive interests in the Pacific. And with the war in the Middle East, we tend to focus our attention on what's happening politically there. And many of us tend to overlook the importance of the military component of our worldwide struggles. So today, we're going to turn our attention both to the Pacific and to our military command. Our speaker today, General Paul V. Hester, holds a bachelor and an MBA degree in accountancy from the University of Mississippi, is now the commander of the Pacific Air Forces and the Air Component Commander for the commander of the United States Pacific Command at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii. General Hester has responsibility for Air Force activities spread over half the globe in a command that supports 55,500 Air Force people. General Hester's present posting is his 21st assignment in his long and illustrious career. He served around the world from Arizona to Thailand, from Japan to Florida. He's also served as Chief of the Air Force Liaison Office at the House of Representatives on Capitol Hill. He has done turns both at the Center for International Affairs and at the Kennedy School, both at Harvard, and has earned a Master's in Military Arts and Science from the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. His fourth star was pinned on him on August 1, 2004. Of his 3,200 flight hours, this command pilot has more than 200 hours in combat in Southeast Asia. Please extend a warm welcome to General Paul Hester.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, good morning, and in the vernacular of the state that I now live in, aloha. We are excited to be here, and I say we, my wife Linda, who is here on the front row, and I are excited to be with you back in Virginia. We have spent so much of our life in both lower Virginia, at Hampton, at Langley Air Force Base, when I served there as a squadron commander, as well as the inevitable four tours in Washington, D.C., where we lived in Northern Virginia, so it is our pleasure to be back in Virginia and to be here at the University at the Miller Center. Today, I would like to just spend a moment or two talking about, as you heard, the Pacific. And as America is focused, rightfully so, on our sons and daughters who are doing our nation's work there on the battlefields in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in other places across that central area of command, area of responsibility, I think it's also useful to ask the question, what else is happening in the world? My friend Tom Hobbins, who is the Air Force four-star general in Europe, were here. He would be telling you about NATO's participation and all the things that are vibrantly going on in NATO and how NATO is a part of that security force that is, in fact, on the battlefield in Afghanistan. And, of course, if my friend Ron Keyes from Langley were here, who has also responsibility for South America, he would be telling you as well about the efforts of the Air Force and other parts of our military as we are working issues throughout the Southern Hemisphere just south of us in the United States. But my area of responsibility for the Air Force is in the Pacific. I've lived there for a number of tours and consequently have been focused there principally since about 1990 when we first went to Japan, and having spent three tours in Japan in the 90s, essentially lived in Japan for that decade, and now back as the commander of the Pacific Air Forces. So why the Pacific? Why PACALF as the shortened version of the name, the acronym for Pacific Air Forces? Why does America invest its sons and daughters out into the western reaches of the world, out past California, and true enough, well past Hawaii? I think first off, before we get to that answer and talk about some of the issues and the differences that we might find between the Pacific and the Pacific Asia region, and I need to emphasize that, and I'll come back to that point in just a moment, is also worthy of comparison to other areas and why the Pacific is important. You will obviously know, as I have in my growing up years, that the focus of the United States has been principally toward the East, principally toward NATO, principally toward World War II, and our declaration that Europe first, and then we'll get to the war in the Pacific, even though it was at Pearl Harbor and at Hickam Field on December the 7th, 1941, that we, in fact, were brought very surprisingly by the surprise attack by the Japanese into World War II. But it was our European first opinion in how we went to fight that war. Along the way, as the Cold War settled in after World War II, we then continued to focus on Europe. That's where, in fact, we were going to meet the Soviet Union in World War III, if it ever broke out, through the Fulda Gap or on the North German plains. And consequently, I spent a bit of my time as a captain and a young fighter pilot sitting alert, Zulu alert, at Bitburg Air Base, ready to go off and fight and see the skies full of MiG fighters coming across the border. And my task, along with my other squadron mates, was to go and engage in battle and shoot them down. But so why PACAF? Why the Pacific now? You may remember in the late 1990s, just before we got to Y2K and we were all worried about our computers, and just before we turned that millennium clock, there were a lot of people in the United States who were writing great articles, some in the periodicals, some in op-ed pieces, who were declaring that if, in fact, this past 100 years was the century of Europe, then our prediction is that the next 100 years is going to be the year of growing Pacific engagement and would in fact turn by the end of that 100 years to be the 100 years of the Pacific. Our own president even made such declarations himself. And yet it was on September the 11th, 2001 that we got sidetracked from what we thought was going to be a full, long-running engagement with the Pacific Theater. While that war is continuing to go on in the Middle East, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there has to be something else that is happening in the world, and that is the part that we're doing. So let me bring you up to speed on what's happening in the Pacific and why those sons and daughters out of America's families and out of America's dinner tables are in fact stationed in places from Alaska through Hawaii to Guam to Korea to Japan and other places throughout the Pacific. Why do we have them out there? First off, the Pacific Arena, which my boss, Admiral Tim Keating, who is the Pacific Area Command commander, is in charge of, and I am his air boss, if you will, doing all things air power and all things Air Force for him. The size of this theater is 105 million square miles, stretching from Alaska down to Antarctica, stretching from the west coast of the United States all the way to the eastern coast of Africa, and stretching not with the word Pacific, because in the word Pacific, we tend to think of the Pacific Ocean and stop our thinking really at the shoreline where China and Vietnam is. But instead, if you go around and hook around the bottom of that through Vietnam and Cambodia, you wind up in the Indian Ocean, and there's as much work to be done there as there is in the Pacific Ocean. So the Pacific encompasses that 105 square miles, about 41 countries. And interestingly enough, in the 41 countries, as we observe, so if that is the ground upon which we base our inbox every day, how many of those people are people that we are close to? How many of those countries are people that we engage with? And of that 41, there are 31 of them who will stand up and make proclamations that they are, in fact, have democratic institutions. Our own State Department helps us a little bit better for the U.S. government view of that, and there's really about 27 of that 41 that we view as some form of democratic principles and thus proclaim themselves to be democracies with some of the same institutions as we have. You, of course, realize that the United States, our version of democracy, is not replicated perfectly anyplace else in the world. And so there are variances on the theme of democracy, and that is where we find the Pacific arena. There, out of those 41 countries, there are some 1,000 languages which we proclaim that people speak. I must tell you, our math sometimes is off, because as I sat in India earlier this year with the air chief from the Indian Air Forces and made that comment that the Pacific arena, including the Indian Ocean, had about 1,000 languages, he laughed at me and said, you need to go back and do your math a little bit better, because we've got about 1,600 languages and dialects here in India. So you'll forgive me if we don't count all those dialects. But the important piece is to know is that there's a lot of people in the Pacific, 60% of the world's population, and there are a lot of languages. There are a lot of countries. There's a lot of area. There's about 75% water. There's about 15% land. And as I like to kid very greatly with my Navy counterparts, there's 100% air and space that covers all of the Pacific arena out there. You can imagine that produces a lot of good-natured kidding between the Navy and the Air Force out in the Pacific arena, because we both think how important it is that we have viable, vibrant, forward-based forces, both Navy and Air Force, out in this arena. The area, in terms of population, if you just look at two countries in particular, India, the smaller of the two, China, the larger of the two, has about a third of the world's population in of themselves. Some 1.2 to 1.4 billion people in each one of those countries. I'm sure that they will struggle as mightily as we do sometimes with our own personal census taking here inside our country. But you balance that against where we just eclipsed 300 million in an official data toll here in the United States, you can see the size variant between the countries that I'm working with in the Pacific and our own country back here in the United States. We also find as well that Indonesia is the fourth largest country in the world. And if you go to India, they will proclaim, as the chief of staff, whom I mentioned earlier, said to me over dinner one night, he said, Paul, I want you to realize that you Americans may have thought about democracy as an idea, and you founded it on different principles of democratic principles than we have here in India. But I want you to know and realize that India is the world's largest democracy. Now, I must tell you, I just sat at dinner for that moment and just was quiet. Because as an American and a democratic country, and how we believe that the birth of democracy came from here, that came as a surprise to me. And then he followed it up one more. And he said, also, we are the largest English-speaking country in the world, with over 300 million whose principal language and first language is English. It starts painting a different picture of how you engage with people, not only in the military as we do business with them, but also the business community is how they do that. And one only needs to go to some of the new rising cities in India, in Bangalore, and see the new Silicon Valley that is being built there. In fact, it's interesting, as they talk about going to Bangalore and standing there on the first tee of one of their golf courses, and you might ask the guy, okay, where's the proper line for you golfers that are here? What's the proper line on this first hole? And as you look down the fairway, you're not looking at the fairway, but you're looking in the distance at the neon signs and the billboards that are much further in the distance that might say Sony, they might say Sanyo, they might say IBM. And he says, just hit it between the Y and the O of Sanyo down at the end. And it gives you a different perspective than maybe the one that we see from Charlottesville, Virginia every day about, one, the world, and two, about a country that exists halfway around the world from the east coast of the United States. It also sets a different a picture for those of us who are in the military, who are doing military engagement for peace and stability out in that region. It is an interesting place to be in the Pacific with the 16 time zones, and thus we spend a lot of time airborne traveling to go do them. In terms of economic value, how does the Pacific stand up in rate? One-third of our trade is in the Asia-Pacific region. You might know that our third trading partner is from exports to the United States is China. Japan's number four, Taiwan's number eight, South Korea's number nine. Canada and Mexico, of course, are number one and two. Also, in terms of military out in that area, we have four of the five largest militaries in the world that are stationed in that arena. So you can see the dangers that exist, both as friends and foes, potential foes in that area. So what are some of the economic dangers we see also in the Pacific across all that 100% airspace and 75% water? The largest trade deficit with countries by the United States is number one with China, number two with Japan. The largest share of the world's poor in the world is number one India, number two China. Those are just indicators and factoids, if you will, that again continue to paint a picture, but also they paint a picture of remembering when our country got started and the rapid growth of our country, as we're watching the rapid growth now economically of India and China, and the need and desire and requirement for raw materials and resources of the world. That produces, quite honestly, competition between countries, competition of which a part of my business, of course, is to represent peace and stability of the United States and protect America's rights, as well as protect America's livelihood across the world. There are dangers that are still out there that we don't hear about too often, dangers such as piracy. Think about the Malaccan Straits. And you'll remember that the Malaccan Straits is that waterway that is bound by Indonesia and Malaysia, starts out into the Indian Ocean on the western side, comes all the way through, and ends in Singapore Harbor on the eastern side. On the eastern side, right. That is a dangerous place that piracy is alive and well. Work by all of the countries in that region have, in fact, found a downturn in piracy, but nonetheless, piracy exists there and is one of the issues that I work with countries in the region in trying to help solve. The combination of most of those issues that I just mentioned obviously produces an opportunity for turmoil. Let me back up a second and let's talk about, so what keeps you up at night? So if we have 27 of 41 countries that are in fact democratic institutions, what keeps you up at night and why is there a concern for turmoil? For we know democracies don't go to war against each other. We know democracies always work in the economic adventure together such that we can find that our countries are vibrant. Well, on any morning you might wake up and find the historical problems that have been present in the Pacific now for a long time. North Korea, South Korea, and the tensions there since the armistice was formed in 1953. And we're still on the peninsula with fighter squadrons, some of our army personnel, and ships at sea to assist with the Koreans to maintain that armistice. There is the political tension that exists across the straits between Taiwan and China. And of course, we're always challenged. My boss is always challenged with the thought about America's policy of the One China policy. He gets most of those questions. I don't. That's his place to discuss those kinds of issues with the Chinese. But nonetheless, they won't hesitate to ask those questions of me, nor will the Taiwanese, as we do business with them in support of the One China policy and our standards for how we will support or not support Taiwan for the future. There's a rumbling in the Philippines, and as you know, there have been a number of internal terrorist groups there trying to destabilize that government for decades. Decades since we left in about 1992 when Mount Pinatubo blew and all American forces were removed from the Philippines. We are there assisting them, teaching them, helping them so that they can solve some of their problems internal. There's the tsunami we had 2 years ago that was off the coast of Indonesia, principally in the Indian Ocean. And when I think about the numbers, I've never found the proper equation to help us all understand the size of this. 225,000 people, as a rough approximation, were killed by a tidal wave, a tsunami. That's a lot of folks. Put that into some association with where you live and how you think about your hometowns in Honolulu terms, that's one-third of Honolulu. We also have the regular tension between India and Pakistan, earthquakes in northern India that we go and assist with. There's always the continued problem in Fiji, in East Timor, in places like Burma, and in Bangladesh, which is a failing state which has postponed their elections, up in Nepal, and of course, as we continue to look at Thailand, they are under a military coup. Most of those places I've mentioned, most of them, not all, are in fact those with democratic institutions. Consequently, without a NATO blanket, place that we can all gather in a room like this representing all of our countries, both at the political level and at the military level, you then find the difficulty of engagement. In NATO, of course, and my friend Tom Hobbins and those who live in Europe, they have the opportunity to go in that room in a circular table, and they can make speeches to each other, they can lay out position papers, they can put forth initiatives, and they can argue about those long into the night, both in the formal room and over dinner. For me to have that same luxury, I get to do it bilaterally with a country because there is no true forum for us to all go and sit in a similar fashion. So once again, you take the bilateral conversations with the Japanese, move to a bilateral conversation with the Koreans, move to a different bilateral conversation essentially with our friends in Australia, and then the same way with Thailand and with India. I've not mentioned China. Our bilateral relationship with China is a very, very slow, as I would like to call it, a very slow dating game. We're just now on the telephone with each other, seeing if we can in fact have a date. I've been invited now to go to China this summer, and we'll go at the end of July for about a week of in-country work with them. And it'll be the first time that we've had, in my experience of the past 15 years, an American Air Force general to go and be a part of a dialogue with the Chinese. My boss, both previous boss, Admiral Fallon, who is now the commander of Central Command, and Tim Keating, who is my current boss out there, have both been to China and have started that dialogue at that very high level. Now it's up to people like Gary Roughead, who is my friend who has been in the Navy, running the PAC fleet in the Pacific, and me and John Brown in the Army, to individually go to China to start that dialogue at the individual service level and see where that leads. Quite honestly, you and I know that the dialogue, while it is interesting at the four-star general level, is in fact only an ability to open the door. The ability for us to in fact develop an engagement policy with the Chinese will come later after I'm able to send my sergeants, my young captains, my majors, the occasion bring them to Hawaii as well as go to China and have meaningful discussions there. For it is there, as people grow old over decades and move into more consistent positions of authority, it is there, at those earlier beginnings, that you start building a level of trust that you can understand either the Chinese mindset or the American mindset. And you can then prepare yourself for the difficult challenges and issues that might come our way when they, too, have become the commander of the Pacific Air Forces somewhere down the line. This will be a long process, but it is a welcome process for us to start. Why is it we want to do that? Well, remember I mentioned India. India is an open society, is a democratic society. China is a communist state and very closed. While they have great wealth that they're gaining because of the economic power that they are, in fact, selling goods and services around the world, they are very closed in terms of their budget. Want to know how much the Chief of Staff of the Air Force or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or even Paul Hester makes in his military paycheck each month? Just go Google it up. You want to know how much that China is investing in its new J-10 fighter or in its purchase of the next generation of fighters in its work with Russia? Go to Google and you won't find it. We are a transparent society, and therefore we're asking China in our dialogue and our discussion, to be more transparent with us. What is your idea and where are you going? Where is your adventurism leading you? Where is your economics going to take you in terms of purchasing? And how far does that economic power do you see and where does it want to go? We can observe, obviously, and our State Department does a marvelous job of that, of observing where China is around the world and where they, in fact, are giving projects to a variety of places. We've observed them in Africa, all over Africa, trying to secure oil deals, to secure a flow of oil to them over the next 20 to 50 years. We've observed them all over the Pacific doing the same. And at each place that they go, they always seem to have a community service project that they want to leave behind. Look at the number of soccer fields that they have built. Look at the number of hospitals that they have sprinkled, and all without strings attached. As they say, it's just because we want to be your friend. And as they go home, they are laying the seeds of an empire that, in fact, stretches beyond their shores. So consequently, we like to have the discussion with them as to what their plans are for the future, and also discuss with them why America needs and wants and desires to be in the Pacific arena with them, as a partner with them, not as an adversary with them. With that, folks, I think I'd like to stop just to telling you some of the things that we're doing in the Pacific, and through your questions, maybe we will find your personal interest on items that I can elaborate on. Thank you again for the opportunity to come and be with you this morning.
I will, as you know, move to the back of the room, and I invite those who have questions. Please don't be bashful about asking questions. I invite those who have questions to meet me in the back of the room and queue up, and we'll take as many as we have time to take. But while I'm moving to the back, General, let me ask about the importance of space in our overall defense of the Pacific and other places. I know you have spoken on the importance of space, and I'm aware also that there are those who worry about the militarization of space. Could you describe sort of where you think we're going in military applications of space and what you think are the appropriate limits on commercial civilian use and then other uses, military uses?
That is a long and involved question. I'll try to give you some thoughts on this.
I walk slowly when I move to the back.
I appreciate that. My friend, General Chili Chilton, who is the Air Force Commander of Space Command out in Colorado Springs, would be the absolute perfect person to articulate all of where we are in space. But through my work with Chili, and obviously getting an opportunity to use the equipment that he manages and leads for the Air Force, we have that in the Pacific. I think it's easy to say that all of us, even those who drove here today in a car with their navigation sitting right there in the middle of their dashboard, are users of space. If you used a cell phone this morning, you are a user of space. And I am a great user of space to try to be able to keep as many of America's sons and daughters in positions where they can do business from one location, but reach out across the Pacific. And the way we do that is through the use of space. Obviously, satellites, the ability to transmit both voice data and other kinds of data through space, the ability to use space to put satellites up in varying kinds of orbits, both low Earth orbits to much higher altitude orbits, that in fact helps both the civilian community as well as the military community. GPS, which I alluded to a little bit earlier, is an Air Force constellation that we have around the world that all of us use in a variety of forms. On the most egregious part of the GPS signal, it in fact helps us guide bombs to be very precise. Now that blows things up and kills people, but at the same time, it's because of the precision that GPS gives to our technology that is on board those weapons, it also helps us to control collateral damage, meaning that we may only need to drop one bomb to kill one target with a much smaller warhead, which then explodes in a much less sized distance than in previous times when I fought in Vietnam, where in fact we did not have precision-guided weapons, and I had to drop many more, as we affectionately call them, dumb bombs, never dumb pilots, but just dumb bombs to kill a target. As you well know, this past January, the Chinese, without warning, to the world community, shot an ASAT anti-satellite missile on a mobile launcher from inside their borders and killed, with a direct hit kill, one of their satellites in low Earth orbit. We obviously saw this as those space capabilities that you have, as and I, as taxpaying members of America, have bought. We have the capability to observe that and did so. That is very disconcerting to us in that work. That was really the first opportunity we have seen, as some might indicate, into the militarization of space. Now, we have pieces in space that help the military, but we don't have weapons in space that shoot anybody, and we don't have an anti-satellite capability that goes up and takes out those kind of satellites, as we observed what the Chinese did. The policies of what is appropriate, which is, I think, one of the more interesting questions. The policies of what is appropriate is, in fact, one which I anticipate will be of great debate as we observe over the next probably decade here. It will be led in a debate both by a couple of things. One is a desire that the Pentagon may very well to have for a weapon that might go to space, or an ability to develop something. That desire or requirement that might come from the Pentagon then goes into the political arena, and that's where the Congress, as you well know, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, will debate this greatly. So that policy will then be formed by, in fact, the American public through their representatives and through their senators there in the public forum of Washington. We will then, as the military and a representative of your government, will be the recipient when that policy is, in fact, built. All the military's responsibility in that policy argument is to articulate what the threat is and to try to articulate as best we can what the risk is, both of developing a weapon of that kind, as well as discussing the risk to the United States of not having that kind of weapon. I think if you'll hearken back to the same kind of discussions we had back in the 1980s when President Reagan was debating with Congress and in the public forum the Star Wars Initiative and how long it has taken for our government to come to some policy decisions, and where we are today in developing a limited shield capability against intercontinental ballistic missiles that we have today. So this is a long process, and I expect to see that the Chinese shot in January will in fact be a catalyst for more public discussion on that.
General, the next question comes from a Chinese major at Columbia University who I think is on the road to a career in government service, public service, and I note with some pride also the youngest daughter of the director of the Miller Center Forum.
Thank you, director of the Miller Center Forum. Thank you for your talk, General. That was really wonderful and enlightening, and I really enjoyed hearing your discussion of China and the growing connection between America and Chinese militaries. But I was wondering if you could talk for a moment about Korea. And you mentioned the important role that the American military has on the DMZ in Korea now. But in the past two or more decades, as far as I know, connections between the two Koreas have been more and more frequent. Back in the 90s, there were family exchanges between North and South Korea across the DMZ. And just a couple of weeks ago, there were trains, passenger trains, that actually went between the two. And I was wondering how you think, assuming that this trend towards greater connections between the two countries continues, how do you think that will shape and should shape American military presence in South Korea?
It's a wonderful question, and I thank you for that, and we're welcome to have you be a second lieutenant in the United States Air Force when you finish at Columbia with your Chinese background. We'd love to have you, and certainly be stationed at Honolulu, at Hickam with us. So we'll look forward to discussing that with you as well. North and South Korea, as you well know, in that devastating war of the 50s, with armistice that is still there. And since then, through a variety of both of kinds of government in South Korea, now into a democratic government in South Korea, and in a democratic government, you find that as we elect both presidents in their country and ours, then the policy of both what the platform that person ran on then tends to shape the administration, and we have seen a variety of administrations in South Korea. Clearly, as they have been democratic for now a bit of time, they have launched off onto an idea of rejoining the North and the South. Yet they don't know, as you might expect, you don't wake up one morning with the right idea that is perfectly to be embraced by everyone, but they've awakened to an idea of wanting to do that without perfect knowledge of how to do that. And so, as you've articulated, some of those very clear and important beginning steps, and I would not want to pour cold water on any of those steps at all, but I would just caution that while we have seen them have families meet, they have not exchanged families back and forth. In that description of that, there is some impression in my mind that people got onto an airplane or onto a train in Pyongyang or Seoul, and that they traversed all the way to the other capital city, and that you sat down and you had a rejoining of families who've been torn apart by some 50 years. And that's just not accurate. However, where we are is a great first step, because we're looking for them to make those decisions, them meaning both South Korea, whom we're supporting with military support as well as diplomatic support, and North Korea, whom we have no diplomatic relations with at all. We're looking for them to solve this problem themselves. And if they tomorrow sign an agreement that they want to join, I certainly cannot speak for our politicians, but certainly from a military standpoint, it then puts a little bit of a smile on our face, a lot of work left to do, but it would put a smile on our face that possibly we're not going to put other Americans in harm's way because they want to shake their fist at each other and throw rockets at each other on that peninsula. There is a long way to be done there with the six-party talks. You mentioned that the train opening up. There's also one piece you didn't mention is that on the east and west coast at the borders of North and South Korea, there is also an economic zone, which South Korea, obviously, with its economic power, is trying to be the leader in helping establish. And the idea is, I mean, in really broad strokes, the idea is that this economic zone would be a place that South Korean businesses can go up and do business, if you will, with whomever in the North, principally through a government agency from the North, take government products produced by the masses in North Korea and then bring them south to South Korea and either sell them in South Korean country or find an export market for them somewhere around the world. Small, important steps. If you're engaging and you're talking, you're not shooting at each other. And it's an important part for all of us to remember. And while that may sound very State Department and diplomatic in its tone, it is exactly the tone that you would demand of every military commander. If we're talking to those who we might go to war with, we're not shooting at them. We're being transparent in what we do every day with each other, and we're trying to provide a place where we can find a measure of trust so that we cannot be miscalculated in what we do. We cannot be misunderstood in any movements we see and in exercises. The harder question you ask is, if they rejoin, what does that mean to America for the future? That's yet to be determined. We have an alliance with the South Korean government. That alliance then would be taken into to account and discussed both at the highest levels. I would expect that the Blue House and the White House of the respective countries would talk and would make some decisions based on what we see as a continuing threat, based on what the charges of the military in both our countries, South Korea and the United States, see as our part to play in ensuring the stability of a joined Korea. So it's yet untold as to how we would respond. You and I believe, I'm going to put you in my pocket as a part of this and say, I think you and I as Americans believe that America must be engaged in the Pacific, whether that means in the long term that we have forces stationed in Korea, either at the size we have today, which for the United States Air Force is two fighter wings, one at Osan and one in Kusan, or whether we, in fact, have forces stationed in the greater Pacific and other locations. And they provide an assistance to the peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. General B.B. Bell, who is the Army four-star general in charge of Combined Forces Command in Korea, worries about this every day. And he is the one then to provide his best military advice, both to our president, to our Secretary of Defense, to our chairman, as well as because it is a combined forces command, meaning Korea and the United States, he provides that military advice back through our ambassador and to the Korean government as well. So it is something to observe in the future. It is a question that has no answer today, but it is a question that will that my prediction is will have relevance clearly over your lifetime.
We have 11 aircraft carriers. It was recently announced that the 6th aircraft carrier in the Atlantic would be moved to become the 6th aircraft carrier in the Pacific. Can you or would you please discuss the need for and the significance of this policy change?
I'd be speaking for the Department of the Navy, but let me just kind of, if I can, repeat some of the pieces that my friends in Pacific Command, Fleet Command, have said to me. I think as a generalized statement, it is in fact a growing acknowledgement of where America will in fact continue to do its business for that next 100 years that I talked about in my opening remarks. So as they take that aircraft carrier, and quite honestly, I don't want to do math in public, but I couldn't count 6 that are already in the Pacific, but that might be a true statement. They are clearly moving, the U.S. Navy, are clearly moving a carrier in the next couple of years and stationing it on the west coast of the United States with its focus, obviously, of being in the Pacific. As you know, the Pacific already has the only forward-deployed aircraft carrier that is stationed in Yokosuka, Japan. And in fact, the Navy over the next year will be changing that out from the last oil burner that we have to a nuclear aircraft carrier to be stationed there with the advice and consent of the Japanese government, who have already given that and are assisting us with the needed requirements to station that aircraft carrier that is there. I think that the simplicity of it is that it is a growing awareness that the Pacific is more important for the future to the United States. The size of it, the complexity of it, the issues and the facts that I mentioned earlier, both economically as well as militarily, as well as population and the draw on resources, means that we will have to commit more of our interest and our attention to the Pacific to continue to provide that peace and stability out that way. If I can broaden your question just a bit and tell you what the Air Force is also doing, in terms of modernizing and updating our forces in the Pacific. While we will maintain the roughly 55,000 that was mentioned earlier, we also have just last summer brought the first C-17s, the large cargo airplane that in fact helps us take our soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and their supplies to all points of the globe. We have 8 of those now stationed in Hawaii. Never did we have any of those, or C-141s, which it in theory replaced. Never have we had those stationed in the Pacific before. Next month, in fact, in 2 weeks, I will go to Alaska to receive the first of another 8 that will be stationed at Anchorage, Alaska, as we now then will have 16 of those magnificent airplanes stationed out in the Pacific. In August of this year, I'll go back to Alaska, once again to Anchorage at Elmendorf Air Force Base, where I'll receive the first squadron of our newest fighter, the F-22 Raptor. You're familiar with it because its first bed-down base is just down the road here at Hampton, Virginia, at Langley Air Force Base. And then in 2010, we will bed down a third squadron of the 7 operational F-22 squadrons. 3 of them will be permanently stationed in the Pacific, 2 in Alaska, 1 in Hawaii, to do America's business. So I think across all of that, you can see that America's military is being repositioned from the Cold War mentality. And Under Secretary Don Rumsfeld's idea about us needing to reposition our military for the next millennium, this is where we have decided that America's might needs to be shaped and modestly boosted, is in the Pacific.
General, I have a two-part question. Firstly, how was the ride at Indianapolis last week? And secondly, what do you see as the role that air power, the Air Force, PACAF, plays in your area of responsibility in our nation's fight against terrorism?
A great question, and I would only tell you, I apologize that I had to have you ask that question because I should have covered it in my remarks. First is, the ride at Indy was absolutely fabulous. For those in the audience might know, we were invited to represent the Air Force at the Indianapolis 500 this past Sunday. Nothing special. Peyton Manning, of course, was the person who dropped the flags and started the race and got that going. We had a chance to meet Peyton. We also had a chance to have dinner with Ruth Buzzi and Florence Henderson the night before. And Florence Henderson, of course, sang God Bless America just before the race started. Our good friend Jim Neighbors, who typically goes there and sings home to Indiana, was ill, and he is back home recovering in Hawaii. Otherwise, we would have seen Jim there as well. I did find, by the way, the next car that my wife needs to get is that Chevrolet Indiana Indy Pace car, the Atomic Gold Corvette. Atomic Orange Corvette. It's a beautiful car. And there is this magicalness about being on the racetrack in Indy and going around and understanding at a much lower speed what those who are fixing to climb into those cars are going to do. And of course, there's probably nothing more exciting, certainly in that sport, than to hear the owner of the racetrack say, ladies and gentlemen, this year, for really only the past several years, ladies and gentlemen, start your engines and watching them go across the line. The role of the Air Force in terrorism is multifaceted. We talked about space, and let me not iterate the pieces of equipment that are in space that help us find, locate, track, pinpoint, and then guide weapons if necessary. And weapons in this case can either be off of an airplane, off of a predator, or guiding an individual to go and kill terrorists, if that becomes necessary. Principally, our job in the Pacific is to, in fact, use those assets, use the air-breathing assets of predators, which are the unmanned aerial vehicles that we have largely flying over Iraq and Afghanistan, with a TV camera looking down, spotting, beaming that back to a central location. We are assessing that data and then piping through space again information, answers, and assessment, and our ideas of whether we have located targets to those back in Iraq. And as you can imagine, we can pipe that information back into the Pacific. If a nation asks us and invites America's Air Forces to bring its air-breathing assets of ISR over the top of their country to assist their government, then we would do so and pass the information we see and the assessment we see back to them so that they and their security forces, their internal security apparatus, can in fact go and take care of the business that they want to do inside of their own national borders. So we've got overhead systems, both in space. We've got air-breathing systems that can provide intelligence, reconnaissance, and surveillance. Then we have, if asked, as we have been asked both in Japan to be there for the defense of Japan and in Korea for the defense of the alliance there, or if we're asked to come and train, as I alluded to earlier, on the ground. And while you think on the ground, you think of Army personnel and soldiers, and in the main, that's exactly right. But if you want to bring America's air power, bring that information, then you take one of our airmen who is trained to walk the ground with the U.S. Army, U.S. Special Operations, the Navy SEALs. You train, take one of our special airmen who has been trained to talk to airplanes, to be able to have the laptop with the John Madden kneeboard. If you remember, John Madden's the one that taught us that you could write on TV screens, and our kids today on the ground with their own TV screen strapped to their leg have a John Madden kneeboard to ask through space to someone sitting somewhere else, Hawaii, somewhere else in America, through the assets of space, can then ask, I've just drawn this circle, tell me what's underneath that point there. That's the communication, that's what America brings, both through its air power. Killing power, documenting power, tracking power, and finding power is what America's Air Forces bring to the war on terrorism. And when asked, we can apply any and all of that, both internal and external, to nations' borders in the Pacific, on the sea or on the land.
General, we've read a lot recently about expanding Chinese military budgets. And in particular, we've read that the Chinese armies or defense system are developing asymmetrical styles of weaponry, presumably to deal with large U.S. carrier fleets in the Straits. In Iraq, we've had a lot of trouble with asymmetrical styles of weaponry. So what do we anticipate in respect to Chinese developments of asymmetrical weaponry, and what are the implications of the ASAT test for that kind of strategy?
I think that if you look at any country that has made assessments of America's military might, and we get this both in our work with individual sitting at dinner with our friends across the Pacific, or with our student fellow students in courses from Harvard to National Defense University in Washington, D.C., to Air War College down in Montgomery, Alabama, when we have the international community that is there as a part of the student workload for the year, you always get them to tell you, we have studied in detail your fight in Gulf War I, your fight in Gulf War II. We have observed your difficulties in places like Vietnam. We have seen the difficulties in your early days in Grenada. We have seen the difficulties even in going to Panama. And what that has led many of the countries to view is, one, if they are a friend of ours and an alliance of ours, an ally of ours, they want to know how they can fit into the broader spectrum to solve some of those problems. If they, in fact, are someone who is not aligned and looks out there and says, if we are looking at people who might be foes of the United States, we know it is only through asymmetric advantage that they can, in fact, meet the United States on the battlefield and have any successes. The United States has built, through our tax dollars, our collective tax dollars, and just a reminder that every one of those soldiers, sailors, airmen, marine, and Coast Guardsmen who wear the uniform for all of us and stand in harm's way are also taxpayers as well. It is a reminder that we have built, as America, the strongest military that has ever been seen. We have done so because of the requirements that were first laid down in World War II, carrying through the Cold War, and the end of the Cold War, in what we viewed as a nation in national policy, as a need and desire, an obligation and a responsibility for America to remain engaged around the world. And that meant, in association with our friends in the State Department, we needed to have a forward-based, large military out there in the world, stationed where other countries would allow us to come and be with them. The ASAT weapon is, in fact, one that, as I mentioned earlier, is maybe a knee in the curve. Maybe it's a knee in the curve in that it is the first, in that it is it requires us to go and redo some rethinking about how we might be able to counter that. How do we counter that to protect our own low Earth orbit satellites? How do we then postulate, can you take what the Chinese did in that shot, and can they shoot much higher? Can they reach out to geosynchronous orbits, and can they, in fact, take out satellites that are there? So there are those who are in the space business who have their slide rules out and their supercomputers working through those kind of answers today. And they will, when those answers and their options come back, they'll bring those appropriately back through Space Command to our chief of staff and into the through the department for work at the highest levels of our government for changes in national policy. The Chinese, though, are looking at different asymmetric pieces. I think it's also logical for all of us to think as we go home and use our laptop computers or our desktop computers or even our BlackBerries to wonder how secure those networks are that run that. We take them for granted. And yet we also know that just a couple of days ago we caught the worst spammer that is out there in the world and got him off the net. And yet it is only in the simplicity of spam that clogs up the internet but does not destroy the internet. And yet there are ways those who are clearly smarter than I in that business, in the IT business, understand how you can take down financial institutions and how you can, in fact, take down electrical power grids in any of our countries. Those are places where asymmetric both offense is a problem to us and defense is a requirement for us. So I think it's logical in our conversations with others that we would expect that any adversary of ours, where that happens to be China in the future, we certainly hope not, but any adversary who wants to do damage to the United States will, in fact, look for that asymmetric advantage, that either weapons of mass destruction or those kinds of asymmetric advantages that, in fact, don't attack our military but take down portions of our eyes and ears and our ability to do our business will, in fact, invest heavily in, and it requires us then to invest in both the offense and defensive pieces.
During the Cold War, we had a bipolar world. Afterwards, we are having a more or less unipolar world, at least in terms of superpowers. Given the importance of China and India that you so well described, do you think it likely that in 50 years we'll have a tripolar world, or if you consider Russia, perhaps a quadrupolar world?
I think that the advent of and further movement of nuclear weapons in countries around the world will certainly provide a balancing effect simply because of weapons of mass destruction as we need to continue to try to prevent those from being exploited and moved around the world. I don't have a prediction for what 50 years will be like when my children will be at about the same spot I am, ready to go sit on the front porch swing and observe the world and turn it over to another younger generation. But I expect, I think logic would tell us, that there are many parts of the world that will change. Economics has already changed, and if we were to extrapolate from where we are today, with the economic power we are seeing rising both in China under a communist government and then under India as a democratic government, they're going to have an amount of wealth that will in fact be challenging to other large economies, ours, Western Europe, Japan, etc. So I think it's logical, whether it reaches the point that someone would hang the moniker on it, that because of either economic power or their development of military power to support that, whether they will hang bipolar, tripolar, quadpolar powers on that relationship that we'll see in 50 years. I would hate to make that kind of prediction, but clearly there will be places in the world that will be a lot richer in terms of finances than they are today. I would counterbalance that with a much longer discussion, which we can't have today, which is, as with the rise of wealth, what comes attendant with those are the difficulties that a nation may find. Even a nation who is either democratic and how they manage that wealth and the tension that wealth in a country presents to the different kinds of people and organizations and regions of a country, as well as the Chinese communist government and how they will deal with a rise of capitalism, money, in their society, and what will that mean to their government. I don't think you can have that bipolar, tripolar discussion without broadening it much further into the discussion of of can they get to that point without addressing other concerns inside their country, no different than how we have addressed concerns as we have grown into an economic power here in the United States.
General, please help me understand the relative large number of F-22s going to Alaska. What is their range, and who would you anticipate them going up against?
Well, as you know, stationing doesn't necessarily mean that people will fight directly from their particular base. And certainly Alaska is positioned in a great place in terms of the world. In terms of geography, it has been noted back in the 1920s and 30s that Alaska was the most strategic place in the world. Far from Alaska, but you can, in fact, go anywhere in the Pacific. From Alaska, you can come back to the lower 48. And from Alaska, you can fly across the top of the pole into Europe faster, easier than you can from Omaha, Nebraska, in the middle of the United States. So it is a place that sits at the top of the world and is great for us to be there. There are some advantages of having those airplanes in Alaska, not only for modernization of the Pacific Air Forces. As I then move out of Alaska, older gray model F-15Cs, which are the air-to-air fighters that we used to have at Langley that were replaced with F-22s down there, also F-15Es, which is a newer version, a fighter-bomber two-seat version of that airplane, as we move those out of Alaska as well. And when we move F-22s into Hawaii, we will, in fact, retire the oldest of our F-15s that have principally been there for the defense of the Hawaiian Islands. When the F-22s come to Hawaii, we will, in fact, have them as a part of the Air Force Air Expeditionary Construct, which means that on a rotational basis, they will be obligated to deploy wherever in the world that we are required to go and present forces for that 4-6 months or a year. And so as they do so, and I have no F-22s in Hawaii to protect the Hawaiian Islands, then I'll bring in F-16s and older F-15s from the United States mainland to Hawaii to sit air defense alert out there to protect the Hawaiian Islands, just as we do with a number of CAFs over a number of cities in a rotational basis and at odd times all across the United States since 9/11. Alaska provides a wonderful opportunity for us to train not only amongst ourselves, me, the Navy, our Marine Corps, but also with our allies and our friends who want to join and learn tactics, techniques, and procedures from the United States Air Force. And we have a wonderful Pacific Arctic range complex up there that stretches from just north of Anchorage all the way to Fairbanks, which is three-quarters of the way up the state. Many square miles of both airspace that is open to us to use and ground tundra for the Army to use as maneuver up there in that beautiful state of Alaska. So those are some of the key reasons why we have chosen to station the F-22 there and to modernize the equipment in the Pacific.
General Paul Hester, we express our appreciation not only for your being here with us today for the terrific discussion, but also for your lifetime of service in defense of our country and in the cause of world peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.